Hi, everyone. Welcome to the inaugural podcast of Hot Switch, which is what we all decided to name it. So I'm Jen, also known as @NotAJenny on Twitter, and I am not a Jenny, which I find funny. I go by Jen, and everybody tends to call me Jenny. I am also the founder slash runner of my very long titled blog. If you read the community blog reviews, I'm the person who writes them at astillandquietconscious.blogspot.com. And I am joined by three of my favorite people in the entire world right now, and they're going to introduce themselves and tell you a little bit about themselves and which blog they run.
I'm Jamie. I'm El Spunko on Twitter, and I run Stories in Your Head at WordPress.
I'm Kim, Drama Kim on Twitter. I am one half of Head Over Feels. I don't know if I'm the head or the feels, but probably
really over
of both.
You're the over.
You're over.
I'm the over.
Can you ever just be whelmed? I'm Siege. I am a brighter yellow on Twitter, and I am the other half of Head Over Feels, so I am the head and the feels. I don't know. And
it's been established that Sage and I basically share a brain, so we're both the head and the feels.
True. But not the over. Yeah, me and Jen are one person, Kim and Sage are one person, so really this is a two-person podcast.
Yes. For a little bit of background before we kind of dive into it, we obviously are all bloggers, and some of us, for me it was just starting off doing these little community reviews that I didn't think anybody was going to ever read, ever. So we've all kind of, we're just all really fascinated with pop culture, and we're obviously all female. We're really talking about things, flailing about things, just like enjoying each other's company. So we thought, what better way to talk together and to talk about pop culture than to start a podcast? And we're all technologically savvy that nothing is going wrong during this adventure. But yeah, we're super, super excited, and I'm sure you guys know us and know how much we really love to each other, and our first episode.
I think Jen came up with the idea of ranking our favorite romantic comedies. I think really just for fun. Like, I think you just want to do it on your own.
Yeah.
And
this
because
wasn't fun, this was horrible.
I know. Well, that's the thing.
It wasn't horrible.
It was supposed to be fun, and then Kim came in and made it not fun. That's what happened.
Exactly what it is.
This is Kim, and what happened she tweeted that she was doing a list of 25, and I thought that was a load of crap. Because if you're going to make a list, everybody knows that a list is either a top 10, or if you're going to be really mean and go by the high fidelity model, which, I mean, really.
Which I almost included.
We probably should have. You should say 5 and be comfortable in your definitiveness of your 5, because it's not necessarily about how much you love a particular movie. It's looking at it for its greatness. And yes, there will always be an emotional attachment, but I challenged Jen to be definitive.
Yeah.
And then Kim is mean. And if you follow us on Twitter, you might have noticed that for a while we would say, I need an adult when something happened. We just started appealing directly to Kim because she is clearly the adult, because this is what she does. And the rest of us just want to sit and make huge, infinite lists of our favorite romantic comedies.
Imposing some rules of order.
Don't be afraid to be definitive, and you got to make some hard choices.
Okay, so we've made hard choices.
But we compromised.
We did, thanks to Chelsea.
Thank
you, Chelsea, because Chelsea decided that, because Kim and I were bantering back and forth over whether 25 or not, was considered a list or not, which,
it is.
There are that contain So 25 I thought was reasonable. You know, it's a reasonable.
There's like millions of, literally millions of romantic comedies.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean they're good and worthy of being on a list.
No, but we can pick out 25 that are.
All right, let's get to fighting about the actual movie.
About the list. Chelsea stepped in and said, why don't y'all compromise? Thought, okay, 15 is doable because there were certain movies that we all couldn't, you know, bear to part with. So, in the spirit of compromise, we all recently, this past week, and you should have read them all, and if you haven't read them all, shame on you guys, because they're awesome. Also posted on our separate blogs our list of top 15 romantic comedies of all time, and we decided we were going to talk about them. I love writing things in a blog post, and we like to yell at each other, so really, this is just what this is. If you're joining this podcast, here's all you need to know. We're going to yell at each other, and it's probably going to end with us just screaming, I love you so much! Oh, never leave me! So, we each picked out 15, which obviously gives us a grand total of, like, 60 movies, and we did overlap. We found that we overlapped quite a bit for certain movies. And so I thought that we could just talk about kind of certain movies that we overlapped in and run through our list of 15. So who wants to start?
So the major overlap, I mean, the most significant overlap, and we can start with that, I think, is that three of the four of us had one particular movie at the top of our list.
Yeah.
Not just on the list, but at the top.
Yeah.
And that is When Harry Met Sally.
Yes.
So, one of us,
which I did
not have that on number one, so we all sided with her, except she had not seen it yet, which is crazy that you would even attempt to make a list of romantic comedies without seeing that movie, but it's been rectified.
Guys, is this what this podcast is? It's an intervention.
This is an intervention.
It's an intervention for Jen.
You know why When Harry Met Sally was your ultimate number one, and whether you knew that from the beginning or you came to.
I completely knew from the beginning. Like, as soon as we decided to list it, I was like, well, I know my number one, so I just need to think of 14 movies. Because during this, there was a lot of just trying to figure out for myself and on Twitter between a lot of people, a lot of talk about what exactly makes a romantic comedy, which I think we'll get to in a bit, but, and you know, there is a formula to a lot of them. There is, you know, certain things that romantic comedies generally follow. And then there's When Harry Met Sally, which basically, as far as I'm concerned, created that formula, and I think gave us a lot of ideas that are now being explored a lot in movies like What Happens If You Fall in Love with Your Best Friend, or the idea of having something change over this long, you know, 12 years of knowing a person. And I think it created so many of the things that we look at today.
There are also just so many elements of that movie that are particularly perfect. And granted, like, the elements don't necessarily make a perfect movie. It's the way, like, the magic of them all coming together. But you think you have, like, Rob Reiner, you've got Nora Ephron, you've got Billy Crystal, young Meg Ryan, Harry Connick Jr. and Mark Chapin doing music. I mean, it's just every particular piece of that to me was just like the highest quality you can possibly imagine to make a movie like that.
The screenplay to me never ages. It remains relevant to this day. It remains forever quotable to this day. You know, it will never age. It will never be dated. And you do see some of, when I was going back and watching a lot of the ones on my list, some of them are dated now. You've Got Mail's incredibly dated. It's still wonderful. But, I mean, it's a picture of the late 90s, you know, and When Harry Met Sally is...
Kim just froze, but I'm sure the end of that sentence was going to be wonderful.
She'll be back. It's okay.
80s.
Oh, there she is.
I'm still here. I'm just saying that end of sentence, and maybe it was a sign that I was rambling, but When Harry Met Sally forever remains iconic, and it doesn't age, and it will remain forever relevant. It'll be relevant, you know, it was relevant 20 years ago. It's relevant today. It'll be relevant 20 years from now. Yeah. And that's what makes it stand the test of time, and why it will forever be the defining movie of the genre. Drop the mic, end of story.
Well, I think even me, having just seen it in full this weekend, because I did make the effort, because I was like, all right, well, before this podcast, I will watch, you know, When Harry Met Sally in its entirety. One of those movies where you see snippets of it on TV, and you really don't get like, a full glimpse of what this story is about. Like, going in, I knew what it was about, but it's true, you know, there's so many fantastic, you know, traditional trophy elements that make it a rom-com. You have the hating each other at the beginning, and, you know, growing to actually become friends, and then falling in love, and then that realization that, oh yes, we have been in love for a long time. Who supported best friends, and, you know, those are, like, great supporting elements, and then you have the comedy aspect, and then you have the whole, well, how do we behave if we're involved with other people, you know, and that kind of, like, I understand now, and that's what I tweeted right after. I was like, I get it now, guys, I understand, because, you know, it is timeless. Like, there's nothing in there, you know, if you would close your eyes and not see, like, you know, the fashion sense or whatever, you wouldn't be able to find out whether or not it was, you know, from 2013, you know, 2009, from the 90s, from the 80s, because those are conversations that people still have all the time. Yeah.
It's the amount of lives that movie has ruined, because they all think that, well, it happened for Harry and Sally, it can happen for me.
Right. Yeah. Meanwhile, you're just getting friend-zoned and... Yeah. until the end of time.
That's a whole other podcast.
But honestly, I think if Meg Ryan didn't have a perm the whole time, if she just had straight hair, you would not be able to know it was 1989.
Except for the jeans.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And
that's
also
true.
The fact that, and I think we'll talk.
Freezing.
I know what she was going to say. I know what she was going to say.
Okay.
Brain, and what she's going to say is the fact that Billy Crystal was cast as a romantic male
lead
who was supposedly like getting all these ladies, total ladies man, and is like a desirable character. And I feel like, you know, actors like that don't get cast in romantic comedies anymore.
Yeah.
I watched the movie, and I went into kind of thinking, like, okay, like, Billy Crystal's supposed to lead. Like, I love Billy Crystal, you know, as a person, as a comedian, but as, like, as a romantic lead, I'm not sure that I'm going to believe, you know, mm-hmm. I'm supposed to swoon, like, when I see him, you know, and hear him deliver lines. And, like, when he was speaking, he reminded me so much of a guy I know, and I was like, okay, I can understand, because he has that kind of, he's not that stereotypical, you know, right. Model-looking, which I think came later. I think that people now, that's probably part of the problem, in my opinion, that romantic comedies, you know, have people that they want to cast who look pretty, and then they try and story around them, rather than, like, playing off of some...
I'm back. I can't even...
Yay! We're probably going to have a lot of technological issues during this, most likely, especially with Kim, because... We're doing this over Google Hangout.
Yes.
Which doesn't like us and doesn't like most of our computers.
No. Doesn't like me especially.
Google doesn't like us.
So if you hear someone not talking for a period of time, it's probably because they, for whatever reason, dropped out of the conversation, dropped out of the Hangout, and we are trying to get them back in.
But what I was going to say before my computer so rudely interrupted me is that another, and we'll cover this later when we talk about, like, the state of modern romantic comedy, but you look at it, and you look at Billy Crystal in that, and if Harry Met Sally was made today, he would never be cast.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what Sage
said. That was what you were going to say. So.
That's why Sage and I share a brain.
We were just talking about that. I was saying, you know, how today, I think that the problem with comedies maybe today is that they try and build around these, you know, actors rather than playing to an actor's natural, you know, chemistry and their natural, you know, features that make them attractive. And what part of the stuff that makes Billy Crystal so attractive in this movie as Harry is that he's this witty, snarky, you know, he's not this perfect, charming, wonderful guy. He's the kind of guy that you're like, oh, I kind of love you. Some of the stuff that comes out of your mouth, I want to, like, slap you, but, you know.
You're also like, I know you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I know that guy.
And nothing relatable at this point anymore.
Yeah, and there, I think a lot of what makes it great is that they weren't really, like, it doesn't seem like to me like they were trying to make a good romantic comedy. Like, it seemed like they were trying to make as great a film as possible, and it happened to be a romantic comedy, but for them, the point wasn't, you know, how can we show Harry and Sally realizing that they're in love over this span of time? It was, how do we get them to change over these 12 years, and they happen to wind up in a place where they fall in love, but that's not really...
smart, Jamie.
It's completely organic, is what it is.
Yeah, yeah, and I think his casting really plays into that, because it's not some... because if it's some gorgeous guy, it's like, what, she totally would have...
done him a long time ago.
On the ride to New York, like... but the fact that he's kind of, like, normal-looking, and he's not, you know, ridiculously attractive, and he says these terrible things, it makes total sense why it would take them 12 years to not just see each other as friends. And
well, and it also is something that, like, would give somebody a pass. Like, if a guy who looks like, you know,
right,
model is telling you that men and women can't be friends because they always want to have sex, blah, 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 you forgive Harry for saying it, because he's just like a funny, goofy guy.
Yeah.
And you see that how that change happens. Can we talk about just, like, it's just one little moment from it and we can move on, but when I rewatched it, just how sincere he becomes when they're doing the waiter, there's too much pepper and bop for crunch. And then he asks her to go to the movies, and it's just like, sincere.
No, not yeah. to repeat, to answer.
I can't stand it. I'm sorry.
And when he's like genuinely like, you should wear skirts more. You look really nice in skirts.
Yeah.
That's something a male friend would like genuinely say to where you as a, because you see Sally's face is like.
Yeah. And I think that's
I wish you could see my expression.
Hand, but like, I'm imitated Meg Ryan perfectly.
And I think that that's the thing, too, that makes it such a great romantic comedy. And part of what I've talked about in the blog is that you have to either know the romantic female lead or want to be her. And I think that everybody can put themselves into Sally's position and be like, hey, this guy's kind of, you know, he's funny, but he's also kind of, you know, standoffish sometimes. Sometimes he says things. But then he says things like that, and she's taken aback, and we're taken aback, because we're like, oh, yeah, you're being genuine. I see it now. And so it's like we start to fall in love around the same time that she kind of starts to realize that, too, which is what, in my opinion, makes a great romantic comedy, is when you follow the same journey that the hero and heroine are following.
Because, and I think that when things like that happen, like, you don't necessarily know, because I feel like a lot of movies, especially movies that are made now, will kind of constantly tell you, you know, oh, he's great, but we're just friends, it's not going to happen. And they'll say that like 20 times in the movie. They say this maybe, you know, twice, and it's very organic when it happens. You know, it's after these time jumps when someone else is seeing, you know, when they're in the bookstore and Marie sees him, and then Sally then has to say, you know, he's a jerk, like, whatever.
Someone staring at you in personal growth.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think the fact that we're not constantly being reminded, you know, this is the plot of the film, this is what's happening, it lets it change, because it's not forcing itself to stay as this one thing the whole time.
Yeah.
So it's changing, and because we're not hearing that, you don't know what they're thinking in every moment. So when he says things like, you should wear skirts more, you look nice in skirts, like, you're just as confused as she is, because you don't know what he means by that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which doesn't happen anymore, but...
it's a very, like you all have said, it's a very natural, organic progression. It's nothing forced. It feels like movement, and it's not like this huge, dramatic, you know, any kind of plot or anything like that. It's normal, which makes it relatable, and it makes it... and something, you know, people want to watch over and over.
And then at the same time, it has ruined New Year's Eve for everybody.
Yeah.
Forever.
That is a trick.
Romantic comedy doesn't run in and
New Year's Eve ruined New Year's Eve for everybody. We won't talk about
well, yes.
not on anyone's list.
No.
But, I will segue that into the fact that even though we all had a little back and forth about whether or not this one qualified as a rom-com, we all also had Love Actually on our list. Is that right?
Yes, we
did. And why is an ensemble film that has a lot of dramatic stories too, why do we consider that to be a rom-com, and why is it one of the best?
Well, I'll just preface this by saying that Sage is correct. There are only two movies that all four of us agreed on. It's very telling that the two movies we agreed on are so different.
Well, yeah. I struggled a long time with Love Actually, and...
Yeah, I remember you talking.
You know, because I often get caught up in the drama of how heartbreaking Emma Thompson's story is in it, and, like, the both sides now scene where she's crying listening to Joni Mitchell. Like, what? And the Laura Linney scene, you know, the Laura Linney storyline. But then there's so much else in that. You know, there's all the falling in love. There's the funny storyline with Martin Freeman and the, you know, their porn doubles, and they fall in love while they're making porn.
What? And they're so sweet.
So sweet. Innocent and cute.
They're
wonderful. And, you know, and also just the fact that when Sage brought up New Year's Eve, that Love Actually has inspired so many imitators that failed to recapture what Love Actually is so wonderful about. And so maybe we should leave all these interconnecting stories to the British.
That's the moral of the story, guys.
Well, also the Emma Thompson story and even the Laura Linney story, there isn't really a big closed door on either of those, I would say. Mm. And because that movie is very hopeful, and she has that moment at the end when they're at the airport and Alan Rickman comes back and says hello to her, and it's very ambiguous. It could be either way. It could be that, you know, they're breaking up, but everything's going to be all right. Or it could be that maybe they're moving in a way to be back together. But either way, it's just that movie, even in the very heartbreaking moments, is always, always hopeful about love, just as a general topic. And that's why I felt like it deserved to be.
Yeah, I think for me, because it is incredibly hopeful the whole time, and I think because... I don't think a romantic comedy is necessarily a movie that has both romance and comedy. Like, it is very much its own thing. It's not just a combination of the two, I think. And so I sort of developed my own definition of it while I was coming up with my list and everything. But I think ultimately it's something that is about love, but in a lighthearted way, where the important thing is that people are falling in love. Which, you know, Love Actually, it has some very dark storylines in it, and then you get that balance of the really happy ones and the really sweet ones, like the, I can't remember his name, but Liam Neeson's stepson in it.
Oh, yeah.
That storyline is completely fluffy and happy and so completely about the magic of falling in love and all these things, and I think when it has those things like that, ultimately seeing those stories next to each other just elevates the darker ones, because it's still coming from that same place of love being a happy, wonderful thing.
Well, for me, I think that I put it on there because, and I was talking to Kim about this, about, like, you know, what makes a romantic comedy a romantic comedy is, does it have to have an ending? Because we had kind of debated, and this was on my 25, and I know it was on your 15, Jamie, but we were talking about 500 Days of Summer. And about how it's not a, you know, he says, it's not a love story. You know, it's not a story about, you know, Hunter and Tom falling in love. But at the same time, it's a story about love. I think that's the core element, like a romantic comedy, is that, yes, it has elements to it. For Love Actually, for me, it was just the flawless way that every story intersected and illuminated every other storyline, to where the characters learned more about love and more about themselves through seeing their own lives and also seeing the lives of other people. And obviously, you know, we have, you know, every type of love in that movie, like, that can possibly be covered. You know, the friendship, you have unrequited love, and you have, like, you know, love that's failing and fading, and you have new love, and you have young love, and so, like, just beautiful kind of tapestry of, like, all of these different types of love. And Sage is saying it just, it is hopeful, because, you know, it's about Christmas. And
yeah, it's not Christmas until you watch it.
No.
Right. Which is why it's on all of our lists, too. It's just, like, the relationship that you have to that movie and the way that there are just some days where you need to watch it.
Need to see Hugh Grant as the Prime Minister dancing around.
You have to jump.
I'll take you down. I'll take you down.
Can't see it right now, but Jamie and Cameron.
I did the point.
They were. Like, I think that's just such a... It's just such a classic movie. Like, it's such a prime example of how you can show so many people's stories about love and how, like, a lot of people aren't as different as they seem. Like, when it comes to love, like, a lot of these stories are different externally, but, like, the internal core, you know, like, I don't know. I'm just kind of rambling at this point. But I really, because it's a flawless movie that gives you hope, and it's all about, you know, even the unrequited love. It ends with a sort of resolution, and then nothing kind of ends, you know, on a sour note. And I think what we love so much is that, you know, it fills us up. You know, some of it just, like, tears your heart out when you watch certain scenes. So,
how have we been talking about this movie and not mentioned To Me, You Are Perfect?
That was my favorite line.
Little baby Andrew Lincoln before he was chasing zombies on The Walking Dead.
Always be Mark with the posters who loves The West Wing.
Yes.
Forget about it.
Yes. Well,
because I think that a lot of what I love about this movie, and I think romantic comedy on a whole allows its movies to maybe not be realistic in a way. Like, it can show this elevated sort of reality when it comes to love and everything. And, I, you know, you see that a lot in this. And I think that's a really good example of it, where is this maybe how this would have been handled? No. But in the world of the movie, like, you can completely let yourself be carried away by Love Actually. Like, you put it on, you're going to sit and watch the whole thing and get super invested in it. And I think that's just one of those things where, and because for me, that's my favorite storyline in the movie, because, and it maybe has, like, four scenes throughout the whole movie because of that one moment, because that moment is so great.
And I think the thing is like, and maybe this is why Valentine's Day and New Year's Eve, and even He's Just Not That Into You, haven't really clicked onto any of our lists, because you root for every single character in Love Actually, or at least one character in every single storyline. Mm. Not one storyline that I'm like, okay, you know, even the really heartbreaking, you know, Alan Rickman and Emma Thompson storyline, like, you still are, like, you were still emotionally invested in that relationship and in that story. And I think that, I think I was telling Jamie about this, like, you know, when I was watching He's Just Not That Into You, I was like, okay, you know, it's a good, you know, movie. I could have done without these storylines. Like, and that's how I know I wasn't emotionally invested, how it wasn't as great as it could have been, is that I could say, you know, with certainty, like, oh, I'd rather have it without having this story. But I think that's what makes a strong movie, strong romantic comedy, is that having an emotional attachment, because romantic comedies are all about love and you need to, and having that investment. Because if you don't care about a character, there's no way that you're going to, you know, root for them, let alone understand why they're suffering or rejoicing or whatever.
Yeah, and because Love Actually, you know, it has two storylines. Like, you know, there's the one storyline where Andrew Lincoln is in love with Keira Knightley, who is his best friend's new wife, and then you have Alan Rickman, who is really close to having an affair. And even though I feel like in any other movie you would instantly hate, you know, you would hate Andrew Lincoln for trying to break them up, and you would hate Alan Rickman and his secretary. but you don't. But, well,
we hate the secretary. We hate the secretary.
We hate the secretary. Hate Alan
Dark Rickman. Corners.
I was mostly talking. Yes, we don't hate Alan Rickman. We hate the secretary.
Hate the secretary. Find me something pretty.
But I think the reason for that, because with Alan Rickman and with Andrew Lincoln and Keira Knightley, we're not, we understand them and we see what they're going through leading up to this. Whereas the secretary, the first time we see her, she's trying to seduce him, which I think because, and he's just not that into you, there's a storyline where Bradley Cooper has an affair. By the end of it, you hate him and you hate Scarlett Johansson for having an affair with him because it's done really the exact same way as the secretary, where you don't see why they might want to do this. You don't see why they're making this choice. They just do it, and then you're just mad that it happened. Whereas Love Actually, and because with so many characters, obviously doesn't have the time to fully explain where everyone's coming from, but you get a sense of the characters enough that you feel like you can understand what they're doing and why they're doing it.
Yeah.
Okay, I feel like we should move on because we talked about like two movies for. So I'm just gonna keep suggesting things.
I was gonna say, Sage was saying there's only two.
because we talked about When Harry Met Sally is kind of setting up some of these tropes, but I mean, I would argue that these tropes have been around forever and ever and ever, and in fact, and I think it was just Kim and I who had this movie on our list, but I feel like we have to talk about Much Ado About Nothing and Beatrice and Benedict as, like, the quintessential mother and father of every rom-com couple that there has ever been. Because there would be no Harry and Sally without a Beatrice.
It's Shakespeare, guys. Come on.
Shakespeare wrote the first comedy.
And the Branagh film, the Kenneth Branagh film, and I have yet to see the Whedon one because I'm a failure, and also because it's been in, like, very limited release, and that's obnoxious.
Well, the only adaptation of this I've ever seen, actually. I just saw it, like, last week or 2 weeks ago, so I can finally have a conversation about Much Ado About Nothing. Yay.
You have to see the Kenneth Branagh version.
And I will.
Next time you're here, we'll watch it.
It is hilarious. And it has Keanu Reeves in it, so...
Well, Keanu Reeves is the undisputable weak link of that movie. You know, and it's like a baby. I think it even was an introducing Kate Beckinsale thing, like because she's virtually unrecognizable.
Yeah.
And then Robert Sean Leonard, who, you know, is forever Neil Perry from Dead Poets Society as Claudio, and Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson, they were like the definitive Shakespeare acting couple. And I mean, I said it in my post, but I'm never going to be over them getting divorced. And they're so wonderful as Beatrice and Benedict, too, that, like, the chemistry and the sparks and the way they deliver the Shakespearean dialogue. I was talking to Sean. Hi, Sean, on Twitter. But how you forget that you're listening to, like, Shakespearean verse because the repartee is so understandable and relatable that you're like, yeah, I may not get the metaphors, but I know what they're freaking arguing about.
Which the Whedon version makes very clear. But yeah, I mean, it's everything. It's people who pretend to dislike each other just to, you know, save some face, and their friends who see right through them and who are just, like, hoping upon hope that these people will get together and creating some kind of crazy plot to make that happen, and how many of the other movies on our list are just different versions of that. So I just think that that's interesting. But someone else want to suggest a movie?
I mean, did we, it may have been while I was lost, but did we discuss Sleepless in Seattle?
No. That is the other movie that only four of us, all four of us agreed on, and it's
another Nora Ephron movie. May she rest in peace.
Because she's queen.
Yes.
So much like Billy Crystal, he's a dreamboat, first of all, and an unconventional Dreamboat.
I would like to take a sidebar to explain why I'm so attracted to Tom Hanks, because I hadn't seen, I think I'd seen parts of Sleepless in Seattle when I was younger, and so one day this year, my friend Katie got really mad at me that I hadn't really seen it or You've Got Mail, so, and she hadn't seen When Harry Met Sally, so we sat in her room for like 8 hours and we watched them all. And so during the course of this day, I realized why I'm so attracted to Tom Hanks. Because as a 20-year-old, it is very attractive to look at him and think, like, that man has his life in order. Like, he's an adult, you know? And I think you see that in his movies, where it's not a bunch of silly things happening, you know, these hijinks ensue that keep them apart. His stories feel like these adult characters who have genuine reasons for not being together. Mm-hmm. Or for not wanting to be together or something. Like, it feels very real, because Tom Hanks feels very real and is wonderful. But that was a slight digression. So back to Sleepless in Seattle.
No, but he does. And you, like, and every... I dare any woman to not tear up, much like Meg Ryan's character does, when she hears the way that he talks about how he loves his wife, because that's something...
How long is your program?
Something sorry, I say that every time. Want, you know, the whole, you know, I'm going to breathe in and out, and then maybe one day I'll remember that, you know, forget that I had it good and perfect for a while, and then the whole, it was like magic. Like, come on, that's been my G-chat status for weeks.
For like
watching Sleepless in Seattle and working on this blog post, because you're like, it was taking her hand and it was like coming home. Shut up. I'm going to try not to drop a lot of her.
I've been trying really hard. Not to.
Family program, Cam.
I'm trying hard, but shut the F up.
And also, I'm sorry, he's freaking hilarious in that movie, too. Like, that's one of the best uses of a kid character in a romantic comedy, maybe ever. Like, Jonah is so perfect, and he's, like, a little bit of, you know, one of those, like, 7-year-olds going on 30, but also... And I noticed this the most recent time that I watched it, because his relationship, like Sam and Jonah's relationship, he talks to him like he would talk to an adult. Like when he's just basically saying, we're going to have sex in your room. Deal with it. Like, and I realize as I'm watching it and I started to give myself feelings is that he needs a partner at this point. Like he doesn't have an adult partner. And the reason that he's going to get through this is by sort of, this kid needs to be a bigger shoulder for him to, like, he needs to be someone for him to lean on. Yeah. He can't just be, like, a kid that he has to take care of. He needs to get something back from his son. And that's why he treats him that way. And it's really sweet and funny, but also, like, ooh, that's why.
Well, and I think that one of the reasons why it lands on my top and why I watch it every single time it comes on TV, like, I watched it this weekend, and it was on probably, like, twice this weekend, so I probably watched it twice, is because, and one of the things that I was just thinking about when you were talking about, you know, Jonah being this great use of the character, is that he's, it's one of those rare movies, rare romantic comedies, where the kids are more insightful to love than the adults are. Mm-hmm. It takes a child for this whole plot to spin in motion. Like, it is Jonah calling into the radio station, saying, you know, in his childlike wisdom that my dad needs a new wife. That, you know, makes kind of, you know, him realize, like, okay, like, why am I being perceived as unhappy? Like, am I really unhappy? Like, am I ever going to be happy again? And it's this, like, it is just so kind of wonderful to have that childlike innocence about love and about finding love and about, you know, about dreaming about it, and like Jonah setting that into motion for his dad.
Well, and what I love about it, and I said it in my post, is that it's unabashedly sentimental and romantic. And movies today, and it is also a comment on like society today. I mean, if we're gonna get deep, but you know, because Hollywood thinks that we're not gonna accept something that's based on pure sentiment and romance, because I mean, you have this movie that's so romantic, and the people that you want to get together do not get together until the final scene, and really
they don't meet technically.
They don't meet. I mean, they just take each other's hands, but you know that it's like magic.
Well, it completely contradicts what I was saying before about Tom Hanks movies, but I don't think it completely negates it, that this movie is so much about romance and the magic of it, because they don't meet until the last scene. You know, they're not dating the whole time or whatever, and which I think makes it so interesting. And because I think they're both missing so much, especially Tom Hanks, where he lost his wife. And in some ways, it feels like the beginning to a romantic comedy, where we're seeing them become the people that they're going to be. Because if he doesn't have that equal person in his life to kind of help him get through this, and it's about them finding each other. But if that makes sense?
No, like a movie that would start when they meet each other on that, like that movie is not. What is, I mean, we're talking, obviously none of us are happy with like the current state of the genre. And I know what the latest movie is on my list, and it was Friends with Kids from 2011, but that's also a big jump. The second most recent movie on my list is from 2004, I think. So I can't remember from the rest
of you. The most recent one on mine, and it was in my top 15, was 2006. But if you looked at my top 10, like, you know, I challenge us to do, most recent one on mine in my top 10 is 2003. So that's 10 years ago. That's a decade.
Yeah. What about the Jays?
On my top 15 was The Proposal, which was 2009. That was still even quite a while away. And I think my second most recent after that was just like 2008, too. So I don't have anything more current than 2009, I think, blanket list on any of my...
I win in this conversation. My most recent is Silver Linings Playbook, which came out last year. And then I have two from 2011, Friends with Kids and Friends with Benefits, because there's a really good year for movies about friends. But I think all three of them are very different interpretations. I mean, I think Friends with Benefits, especially because it's very, the whole time, you know, Mila Kunis' character is very obsessed with romantic comedies, which Justin Timberlake like teases her about. But so they're very aware of the tropes and like the cliches that, you know, people go through and everything. And so I think, and that's what, I mean, I ranked it as number two because I just genuinely love that movie. But I think it's so interesting because it came out, you know, 10 years after, you know, maybe the last great romantic comedies did. Because it's very aware and critical of what's happened to the genre. And it's sort of letting itself poke fun at that while still sort of playing along with it.
Yeah, I thinking about the comments that we were getting, like, I think it was Chelsea who suggested Warm Bodies, which is a movie that I loved, and I do think it is it's a good example of a romantic comedy, but it's also an example of the way that romantic comedies have to be positioned to be made, which is at this point,
under a layer of a whole bunch of other crap.
It's got to be a genre. It's got to be genre something. It's a romantic comedy filled with zombies. You
right.
Know? Romantic
it's comedy. A bromance Judd Apatow movie that still has some crude stuff in it.
Which is fine. I almost put Knocked Up on my list, but, you know, just I think what we're talking about is such a specific style, and it's not that people aren't making movies that have this sort of satisfying romantic conclusion. It's just that it's this genre that started, you know, in whatever It Happened One Night, which I think was like 1934 or something like that, until arguably mid-2000s, and now is just sort of not existing or petering out. Yeah. Just this specific kind that we're
talking about. I mean, you look at it, that it used to be every summer there was at least one romantic comedy that would open opposite a blockbuster, because there would be some sort of like counter-programming for the women. That has not happened this summer. Like, I don't know when the next even kind of geared to that is opening, and I think that's a statement of the death of the genre, honestly. So,
the Silver Linings Playbook, I love Silver Linings Playbook, but I would...
That is not a romantic comedy.
I think that as like a family comedy, or a comedy about, you know, more about his character.
I think,
mental illness, really.
And I think a lot of the problem was that we were, and we had a lot of, you know, kind of heated Twitter debates about, like, what typifies comedy, like, and where is the line? And I think that it's kind of like, it's obviously different. It's a personal line for either people, but I think a lot of focus has now shifted into, and this is why, without having seen it, would classify, you know, Silver Linings Playbook as like a drama. And yes. It's like a lot of...
I would put it with Jerry Maguire.
We're just enjoying, I think that, you know, American movies are particularly enjoying that, like, niche drama that's just kind of expanding. They're like, well, we'll have something for the girls, but we'll also not make it too, you know, girly, and something for the guys, and we'll make it deep, but we'll also make it funny. So I think that that's the problem, is that you don't have, like Kim was saying, these blockbusters, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, for girls, and then the guys can go see some action-y movie. They're like, how can we incorporate, you know, kind of the elements that make movies intriguing for both sexes, and put them together and make this movie that everybody is going to go see over, you know, this movie.
Yeah, and I think you're definitely seeing a lot more of that now, where because when I was making my list, there were some things that I would think of, and I, like, for example, Warm Bodies, which I haven't seen it, but, like, I think it's a good example of it, where I would be thinking of movies to put on my list, and I would take some out because they had some sort of gimmick or something, where it's, you know, zombies falling in love, or I can't remember any other ones that I decided against, but something like that, where it at its core, it isn't really just about two people falling in love. And I think Silver Linings Playbook, I think there could have been a movie like it, maybe like 10 years ago or something, where you get that same thing where, you know, they find each other and everything. But I think for when it came out, it is the only way it could have been told, because of how people are becoming interested in movies now, where they want it to have multiple things, or they know in order to get it to do really well and to be received really well, it has to appeal to as wide an audience as possible, instead of just, you know, okay, we're going to make this for women, or we're going to make this for men or something.
Yeah, and then you have, like, movies, I think now more are kind of walking that line, and I think I was scrolling a Tumblr post today about this, about kind of, you know, feminism and stuff in movies, and going through these lists of movies, and they had noted, you know, Pitch Perfect as being this movie that both guys and girls enjoy, while it's still having a romantic element, it's more appealing to, you know, both genres, or both genders, rather. So I feel like a lot of movies are kind of steering towards that, well, let's just incorporate this tiny love story to get people who want to go see that kind of thing intrigued, and then we'll incorporate all of these other elements and kind of blanket it over it, rather than just having a straight-up romantic comedy, because, you know, there are straight-up romantic comedies that obviously do exist, but I feel like the problem with those, or at least the ones that I found, and that's why, you know, 2009 being the most recent list, and before that, 27 Dresses. Like, 27 Dresses and Proposals, I typify as straight up romantic. I mean, they...
Yes, well, they are.
Yes, they are. And those are the latest ones that I have on my list, because they, you know, right now it's more or less like, okay, how can we make more people see this movie, but not, you know, shoo away the people who don't necessarily want to watch a love story and be bored by it. And I think that the problem is that people are making them, quote unquote, not, you know, wrong to us, because they're trying to, and maybe this is the problem that I have with a lot of TV shows that do this too, with romantic pairings, they're trying to please the audience rather than actually do well by the characters.
yeah, and it's like, I think there's, like, this last ditch, like, kind of, like, the last gasp of romantic comedies as we think of them. We're just kind of studio heads, like, throwing things at the wall, like, let's take this gorgeous guy, this gorgeous girl, Moment of wall and see what happens. People will want.
I mean,
they're so cynical and they're so heartless. And of course, no one responded to them. Even they were like, even the women don't like this. Stop making you know, because they had no soul, because they had, you know, 8 different screenwriters who were writing one story, because no one was putting any care into them.
I mean,
care hasn't been put into them. And that's something that I thought, like, in watching Friends with Kids. It was like, oh, so, this is meant to be a good movie.
Yeah, and I think, because for me, I think a lot of, which I think in general is why a lot of people just don't take romantic comedy seriously, because they think, well, it's just about two people falling in love. And a lot of them are like that, and you can have better versions of that story. Like How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, for example, I love everything about that movie, but it is really just, you know, not even when you break it down to its basic element. It is completely just about two people falling in love, and then you have something like Friends with Kids where there are more complicated things going on, and that is the heart of the story, these people falling in love, but it's a much more complicated version of that. And I think that's where my more recent movies on my list, that those are the ones that I chose, where it's not just, you know, there are other things going on, because I think that, in general, I think that's going to make more people want to see it if it's, you know, not just about that. But I think it's maybe now more interesting in a time where I think people have kind of just written off romantic comedies as being very simple and, you know, too fluffy and too unrealistic and everything. And
it's just that they're unwilling, I feel like, to write intelligent ones.
Yes.
Right.
You know, because yes. All the ones on our list, I mean, let's be honest, they're all intelligent.
Yeah.
Smart, you know, and it's they've forgotten how to do that properly.
Yeah,
like thinking about While You Were Sleeping, particularly a movie like that. As I was rewatching it, I was like, this would never get made today.
Yeah,
not ever. It is too sweet. It is too simple. There's no sort of mean best friend or mean element in it. And it doesn't have any little bit of edge. No edge.
Right.
It doesn't have any edge because it's funny without that. It's engaging without that. But it's like this sort of imaginary edge that these movies need to have that I think ruin a lot of things, like right when you're throwing those ingredients in.
The problem is that when you lose the heart of a romantic comedy, which the heart of a romantic comedy is to me too, a kind of heart, if you will. It's a love story, but it's also a story of growth with these characters. So, you know, you can throw a character, you can throw a movie at me that's, you know, like, look at these attractive people, look at how much they like each other, but there's some obstacle. Look, we've overcome that obstacle. Look, now they're together. But if you lose the heart of those characters, and particularly in a great romantic comedy, you have, like we were saying, you know, these stories of Love Actually, and stories like You've Got Mail and Sleepless in Seattle and While You Were Sleeping, if you lose the hearts of both the romantic male and female lead, or one or the other, you lose. Your story falls apart. It's nothing more than just, you know, oh, he's pretty and watch them do stuff for like an hour and 30 minutes. Like, you have to have some solid engagement in the characters and in their love story. You can't have just, you know, just a love story. You have to have something else there. And that's what makes something like Friends with Kids such a great, you know, movie in general, is because it is about two people falling in love, but it's also about the love. More than that, and it's about like all of these deep elements that make up kind of the human experience. And maybe that's the problem, is that these characters they're constructing now are mainly kind of like shadows of what these studio heads or these writers think a romantic lead should be, or think of, you know, a love story should look like, not to an actual part, an actual character flaw. Like, I love 27 Dresses because I love Jane's flaw. I love that she realizes that she is flawed. But I love that it's a story about her. I think that I talked about this in the blog. Yes, too. It's a story about Josie learning to love herself. And that's that's what makes the love, the actual love story, even more powerful, is that you've got this character who's on a journey from point A to point B, and somewhere in the middle they meet their romantic lead, and then they get to point B, you know, on their own, and then they go.
Yeah. Well, I think this is something we can discuss further in episode 2.
Yes.
Because I feel like there's a lot we haven't even delved into the Julia Roberts canon of romantic comedy. And I have a lot to say about My Best Friend's Wedding, but we've already been talking a lot. I feel like Jen's last point is a nice ending point, jumping off point, teaser for episode 2, where we discuss the romantic comedy heroine, I think. And I think the importance of her journey and how it used to be then and how it is now and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
All right.
That's my opinion.
Well, thanks everyone for listening. If you did,
we'll also in episode 2, I think we should defend our, because several of us had choices that no one else picked on their list, and I think we should defend our list of, you know, solo entries as to why they're worthy.
We're going to go and bring out the boxing gloves, and like, you're not going to see it, but we're actually going to fight each other about, you know, romantic comedies and why I have so many Adam Sandler comedies. And
yes, we didn't even delve into Drew Barrymore.
Not even Drew. Guys, you don't understand how much I love Drew Barrymore.
Have you seen My Date with Drew? That's like a documentary romantic comedy.
No, but it's on my list. But
so tune in next time. Those like three of you who are listening.
Thanks, Twitter friends.
Thanks, Twitter friends.